Hi, everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political right Representative Ryan Wilcox.
Good morning, everyone.
And on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello. Special shout out to listener Paul. Thanks for saying hi recently.
Well, I want to start by talking about presidential politics. You guys okay with that?
Yeah. Sure.
I don't know where to go there, but I just wanted to bring up this third party candidate issue that keeps kind of developing. And it gets particularly interesting because our third party candidate that we hear so much about is a pretty interesting guy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
So, am I picking my words right there, or would you be more colorful than saying interesting?
Oh, well, he's crazy fun.
Yeah, I would be more colorful. I would say the thing that is most interesting to me about the Kennedy path, right, is that we're seeing some really interesting ways in which he's showing up on the ballot, right? Mm-hmm. So that's curious to me, first of all, that sometimes he's joining a particular political party to get on the ballot in places like Michigan or whatever it might be, or that party is deciding to nominate him as their candidate. He is going to be on the ballot in Utah. We do also know that this is a person who, I think, you know, initially the sense was that there would be a huge detraction from people who are sort of apathetic about Biden that might go in the direction of Kennedy. And the more information people have, voters have on Kennedy, I think we're seeing that the opposite might be true. There's mm-hmm. a sense from Republicans now, and in small ways, Trump is starting to attack Kennedy, suggesting that there is maybe some evidence in the polling that Kennedy may be a problem for Trump.
Yeah. How do you see that, Ryan? Because the conventional wisdom for me is that, you know, he's RFK Jr. He's going to hurt the Democrats.
No, I think we've talked about this a number of times, but I think there's a large section of the country that is really uncomfortable with both major party candidates. They just are. And so probably this year more than any other year, there's a window here that Kennedy has picked up on. And I see it from both the right and the left, also both uncomfortable with different aspects of his platform and some of the things that he says. But, you know, certainly his stance on COVID, you know, has resonated with the right and frankly with the left. Bill Maher last week, he's going off on some of the things that JFK's been right, or JFK.
RFK.
Wow, and see that thing? It just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah.
It's all good. Anyway. But that's part of the thing about
Bill
him.
Bill Maher is not the standard bearer for the left.
No,
I just want to be clear
not.
On that.
No, I just mean generally lefty guy, right? In the public talking about this stuff. But anyway, yeah, I think there is appeal on both.
So this most recent story about people questioning his health, having some abnormalities in his brain. He said publicly, mm-hmm. this is Robert F. Kennedy Jr. saying that a worm got into my brain and ate a portion of it and then died.
Yeah. So, and I actually think what else is concerning about this is the reason in part this was disclosed is because he was using it as a way to get out of paying alimony, I believe.
You can't make up this stuff.
No, it is. Truth is, right? Stranger than fiction. But I feel
strange.
Like for me, the bigger issues are politically, like what is the ideology that's driving him? It is quite chaotic. And I don't really think we have a strong understanding of what it would mean for somebody like Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to lead this country. That should be enough for us to move this candidate aside.
Mm. Okay. I'm going to bring Warren up another Graham's issue, totally different realm. But one of our most important U.S. manufacturers, Boeing, is having all sorts of trouble. Needless to say, they've had these most recent accidents. They had one in Senegal where an aircraft caught fire and skidded off the runway. They had another one in Turkey where an aircraft, the tire burst upon landing.
Yeah.
And I'll speak from an economist's point of view, but this is really bad for American industry when a flagship manufacturer has this kind of trouble.
It's also an institution that's interesting to me as a person who was trained in operational excellence, like some different kinds of approaches to mm-hmm. improving workplace efficiency. Boeing is often, there were many examples of things that Boeing had done over the years that are kind of brought into that larger discourse on efficiency and mm-hmm. excellence in the workplace. That is not what we're experiencing now. Mm-hmm. So what has happened at Boeing? This is a really big question.
Ryan, what are you seeing here? Because do you agree with me that this is very hurtful to the U.S. Brand reputation, even the economy? And what do you make of it?
Yeah, no question. I mean, there are certain companies that are synonymous with America, right? Like Ford, no matter how many plants are in Mexico, will always be viewed as an American company. Boeing's one of those in the aviation industry. That's the major competitor. You're up against Airbus, and it, frankly, years ago, the American firms, the American airlines, started buying more Airbuses.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a reason why that took place. It is disconcerting. It's not just the commercial space and the brand damage, or you know, the real damage mm-hmm. that's happened. I mean, you have doors flying off the jets, like
terrifying.
First week of the year.
You know what I would do? I'd get Senator Romney employed there, but quick.
Well,
he turns companies around.
He's a fantastic executive. I'll agree with that. There's also a very real consequence here that we don't really want to talk about, and that's Boeing's, you know, space in the national defense industry. What does their place here in Utah? Hillier Air Force Base, the operations that we've already contracted with them here. Are there reasons to question that? I sure hope not, right? We have thousands of people that are employed here that are directly connected to us. We are the hub for Delta here out of Salt Lake City International Airport, and we rely on Boeing jets. So we don't, mm-hmm. man, whatever that is, you know, I know there's hearings now and there's talks of those things happening, investigations. We got to fix that.
Get that fixed. Shireen, let's go back to campus protests, only this time we've got the really unfortunate, you know, response where we get hunger strikes
yeah.
at Princeton.
Yeah.
And I think they've got, you know, a dozen students and several faculty members joining in a hunger strike.
Yeah. So these are, I mean, I hope that we can agree again that this is a form of peaceful protest. Mm-hmm. This is a demonstration. I do appreciate people continuing to raise deep concerns mm-hmm. about what is happening
mm-hmm.
To Palestinians in Israel, what is happening kind of in the broader scheme of the way that our university campuses mm-hmm. may invest in and support the mechanics of war.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that we see there's just so much uncertainty in this space. It's really hard to know what's going to happen, but I appreciate people bringing attention to the issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Ryan, you want to add anything there? I mean, it's always a sort of a bellwether moment in protests when hunger strikes start to occur. It shows the depth of the, anger, frustration, commitment of protesters.
Yeah, I don't know how to reconcile the stuff that I've seen there. You know, we've had several press conferences where somebody gets up purporting to represent them and, you know, saying that it's a humanitarian issue, that they're not being brought food. Like, either we have fresh oranges or you're not honoring your commitment to your students at Columbia, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
To, okay, so we bring you whatever that is, and now we're not going to eat it as the form of protest. I don't know. Like, I think to most of the country, it just is an oddity. I don't think it actually moves the needle with policy at all.
Have mm-hmm. you protested?
Have
ever?
I protested ever? Yeah, I think I have. But I certainly haven't starved myself or anything like
You've marched. Demonstrated.
Marched. Stood with signs, yes. I've done those things.
Okay.
And chanted.
Yeah.
Chanted on occasion.
Yeah. Can you think of would you share one? Well, we can, maybe we'll
a
come
chant.
Back to it. I mean, just like, well, I'm curious what you've protested. Like, have you protested?
Yeah,
I bet you have.
No, I can't think of any. I can't think of any.
Okay.
This is not a regular occurrence for many of us on the right.
I'm a productive middle person. I don't go to the extremes very often.
Yeah.
Yes. And, you know, and I tend to respond like when when a constituent invites me to something, I'll go to the thing. Like if it's a sincere, like real thing, right? And I think the closest thing that I've done to Shireen Gorbani style protest.
Oh, you don't know what I do.
I don't know. Just based on the question.
Yeah, I'm just curious.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah.
Based on the question, she's got some good stories.
Outside the Bennett Federal Building in 2010, I want to say.
Yeah.
It's not in my nature, Shireen.
Yeah.
I'm the youngest of 11 children. I have 7 older brothers.
Yeah.
I'm the type that's always trying to get people to the center, to get along, you know, and those kinds of things. And so I don't find myself drifting to the extremes very often.
Yeah.
Well, I think
I get mad at Real Salt Lake matches at the refs. That's about as animated as I get.
Sure. So I just want to share that my very first experience protesting, and I feel like I've talked about this before, but my mom was a deep protester of the Vietnam War, was part of the, protests it was at the University of North Dakota, where she was, I would say, politically incredibly active around those issues. So it was part of my family's story. Also, my father's from Iran, and they met during the fall of the Shah. So, like, I think protest has been a part and, like, just a part of my life, probably in a different way than it has for you all. But I remember that I also went to a Catholic school, and in that school, every morning we would pray. And a form of, I think, protest, early protest for me, was that every morning I would pray for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't.
This is in your mind, or you praying out loud?
Out loud.
Okay, gotcha.
And I would make everyone in my class in seventh grade come with me on a journey where I would say, if we're going to spend this time reflecting, I would include a prayer for peace.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me, I think, was the beginning of it, though I've been in many streets and certainly at our Capitol a number of times as well.
Hey, one last topic in this segment. Let's talk about what Governor Cox is doing with the National Governors Association and his Disagree Better.
Okay.
Yeah. What are you seeing? He's getting a lot of national publicity for this. He's been on a lot of important stages doing this. Ryan, are you seeing it's making a difference?
Nationally?
Mm-hmm. Or even locally.
I think it is. I think it's clearly turned into a pejorative locally, at least within the Republican primary. Mm-hmm. It's used.
So more nationally than locally, and that makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's being attacked locally for, trying to...
Well, because here it's cast as, he's too soft, he works too much with the Democrats, he agrees with them too much, and therefore he adopts policies that are damaging to the state.
Yeah.
That's what they're saying. But that's not what the message of Disagree Better is. Disagree Better is you still disagree. Like, the first word is disagree, right? It's, we need, frankly, more models of what that looks like. And I really enjoy the ads that he's done. And mostly because I know these people too. Like, I know Governor Polis over in Colorado, and I've watched him interplay with Governor Cox.
Mm-hmm.
And they disagree, like legitimately disagree.
Yeah.
And they do a good job of it.
Shireen, I saw Governor Sununu from New Hampshire.
Yeah.
On, I don't remember if it was CNN or whatever.
Yeah.
National broadcast, but he talked about how Utah was the number one state from U.S. News and World Report, but the number two was New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
And then he's saying all sorts of praises for Governor Cox, but it's just an example of where our governor is getting some national play.
Yeah, interesting. So I think that it's easier to do on a national scale. And I know this sounds strange, but I feel like when you don't actually have to demonstrate what that looks like in the community level and your own state, it's pretty easy to go out there with, I think, an important idea. But I would really love to see our governor lead out on some big issues here where we're having community conversations around this notion of disagreeing better. I would like to understand what it would mean for us to engage seriously around the issues of the book banning that's happening, or trans issues, or honestly, water policy. Like, let's come down to the basic things. How is it that we're going to disagree better in our own state?
Super interesting. Hey, in our next segment, we'll talk some more really interesting local news. I'm Natalie Gochner with Ryan Wilcox and Shireen Gourbani. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
Ryan Wilcox on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen, it's always fun when you've got a representative of Ryan's stature in the studio to just get a little bit of insight about legislative session. We just had a special session.
Well, so this is the thing. I feel like most people, though probably not our listeners, who are deeply engaged in the political process. But when we think about the legislature, I think we think about the beginning of the year, right? Mm-hmm, right around MLK, that usually starts right around January 15th and then goes for 45 days. And there's a lot of interest activity. I think we're so focused on our legislature at that time. But in fact, there are regular meetings throughout the year. Mm-hmm. So we just wrapped interim. Ryan, can you just tell us, what is interim? What is it?
Yeah, yeah. It literally just means in between.
Yeah.
In between the meetings. But the reality is the legislative session for 2025 doesn't start the third week of January. It started on May 1st at midnight, which is about the time I filed half dozen bill files.
Right.
Right. Interim really is where you start to vet that stuff. You come up with study items after the session, which is where you look at, what did we accomplish? What did we need more work on during the session? Everyone probably at this point knows, because the media talks about it a lot, that there were about 1,500 bill files that were filed. And about 500 or so
bills that actually passed that weren't vetoed.
And on this point of study items, help our listeners know how formal that is, because it's actually like spelled out. Is it in a bill? Is it just in legislative intent language?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll just tell you exactly how it works. So I am, you know, chair of law enforcement and criminal justice. So in my space, things that we worked on during the session that either didn't pass or that we decided we wanted to study longer before we work, you know, before it was ready for prime time. Those kind of things are on there, and also emerging things. So I had basically a series of meetings, you know, across the law enforcement world, try to understand what do people see coming that we needed to address. And that's across the gamut. That's like with prosecutors and defense attorneys and, you know, the courts and the correction system and, you know, libertarians and the ACLU. It's like all through the gamut. You have those kind of conversations to decide what you put on the list. And then you submit a list to leadership. So the committee chairs will submit a list to legislative management, and they will go through and authorize, you know, that's what you're going to do. In our case, in our committee, that led to the creation of two different subcommittees, and we haven't done that in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We eliminated a lot of task forces and different things during, you know, that hadn't been used properly or hadn't been used for a long time during the session to save money and to be more efficient. And we consolidated a lot of that work into the interim process. So whether people realize it or not, the interim process just became way more important by eliminating all these other peripheral things and putting it into the public space. So we have a subcommittee on organized crime that I've been studying and preparing for. Coming up here this week, we'll officially authorize that subcommittee, and it'll start work in June. And then when it's super boring, it sounds super boring, criminal code recodification subcommittee. But that actually is... It really affects how that process works. This criminal justice system works for all
or
of
doesn't.
Us.
Yeah.
Shireen, isn't this fascinating, right? Because you see how in the weeds a committee chair is, and you see how the legislative session is so much more than 45 days.
Right. And I always tell people, if you want to start to shape how your representatives think about a particular issue, heading into the session is not the time to reach out to them. By the end of December, I mean, by then most people are kind of doing holiday stuff and then kicking off into the new year, they are too busy genuinely to engage in meaningful connection building around particular issues. So if you're advocating on something, now is the time to figure out who represents you, get connected on those issues, start those conversations, you know, ideally before May 1st, honestly, but in this time, you have so much more of a, I believe that it is incumbent upon those who are in elected office to engage genuine, like meaningfully and faithfully with their constituents around issues that they care about and bring to them. But they just don't have time when it comes to the session. So please do it early and engage on these issues now.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons we've talked about the caucus system. One of the advantages to that is that elected officials are sort of forced into that place in March and April of election years. And so you are hearing a lot of feedback.
Yeah.
Like direct, like, what did you like that we did? What did you wish we'd done differently? And that, honestly, that process changed my approach on the election bill. Right. I heard way more about that than I'd expected to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just curious, Ryan, how much time do you spend in a week on your legislative role?
That is classified information.
The reason I'm asking is what you described to me sounds like a full-time legislature or a full-time job. Now you're a chair and you've got some seniority in different things, but I just really asked the question, has the needle moved too far towards a full-time legislature?
So, and this is a hard answer because there are different versions of legislative service, just to be totally frank with you. There are some that will, you know, do the thing that you see publicly and then that's about it.
Yeah.
And then there's the really good legislators, I would say, like the really active that are actively doing all the time. They're working a lot. Like they're working, like their lunches are this kind of stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
I used to do my school visits on my lunches, for example, when I served last time. It can easily be a full-time job. It's just the difference is it's got to be not because you're making a lot of money because you don't get paid for any of that. It's because you are invested in what it is that you're working on. That's That's got to be why.
We're getting a pretty good deal, Shereen. If they're spending this much time.
I think this is a real question because this was my experience on the county council too, right? Mm-hmm. Where I was serving almost a quarter of the state's population, right? Mm-hmm. Like a third of the state's population. Yeah. A huge amount of people, over a million people, representing a million people in our state, trying to understand how a Tuesday was going to suffice for the amount of community connection, understanding, you know, major systems run through county government.
I was about to ask you this. You guys are also part-time.
Well, I'm not on it anymore, to be clear to listeners. But yeah, it's part-time. The pay is, I think, a little bit better than the state legislature. But there, I think, is a serious argument for how much we pay people for public service and how fundamentally I think it devalues and creates barriers. If you are not independently wealthy, how do you make time
or
to
work
do
for a company that just lets you do
just
it?
Just lets you do it.
Mm-hmm. No, this is a very real, man, this is fun. Hey, this is a very real conversation. So if you're right, exactly. If you're not independently wealthy or you just, somebody that you don't own your own business.
Right.
Right. It is a real impediment to being able to serve. At the same time, my counterpart states that have gone to full-time legislative service to try to counter this stuff. Generally, the ones that are always in the hole, that I think there's serious value to the citizen legislature in that they have to go back and live with the decisions that they make. They run the businesses in the environment that they helped create or not. Right. So I don't know what the solution is with that.
But I also think that there are so many financial barriers to service, right? And we know this. And fundraising is a huge part of that. Yep. Do you have a long list of people that you can call for money or not? Is going to be really one of the first deciding points of whether you decide to try to run for office or not, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
So I understand the role that money plays in our politics. But I think when you get there and you cannot, it's not at least a bare minimum living wage for the community that you are representing, it is difficult to understand why people would make this decision.
Okay, I got another question for you, too, off this topic. So I lead the Gardner Institute. We do a lot of economic demographic work for the state. I'm trying to focus our public purpose research agenda on things that create the greatest impact.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You know, I'm just thinking through it. So, you know, work with my team, come up with a list. What are the issues creating the greatest impact in our state right now? Anyway, guess what makes it on the list?
What?
Capital city, sports, entertainment, education, culture.
I was going to say, is it anti-poverty agendas in our state? No, it's not. Okay,
well,
so go ahead.
We've got a lot of health and human service stuff on it.
But
the reason that Capital City makes it on it is because we're at the front of some major decisions that will affect this state for, you know, multiple decades.
Yeah.
And so it's on the list.
It's on the list.
And so, I just think it's interesting. What should we talk about when it comes to sports, entertainment, education, and culture in our capital city?
Well, I feel like it's difficult not to talk about what's going on with hockey. So do we have an update there?
Yeah.
Well, the survey's out, got released this last week.
This is for the name.
This is for the name of the NHL Hockey Club in Utah. And, you know, my favorite name didn't make the option list.
Mm-hmm.
The Raptors.
Oh yeah, I think that'll
Utah
go to
Raptor.
Baseball.
Come on, guys.
I think the Miller family will buy out Ogden Raptors and get that
for
our team.
It'd be okay if we made the Ogden club like the single A club. It's fine. Uh-huh. Then, like they work for the Dodgers.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, but the other options grown on me a little bit. I don't know what Ms. Shereen voted for, but she did tell me she voted.
I did vote.
You've got Mammoth has grown on me. Outlaws. Yeti, I think, is still my favorite of the ones that are on the list, as long as it's not Yetis, because that's dumb.
It's already
Black
perfect.
Diamond
Yeti's
was
awesome.
On the list.
Black
I remember.
Diamond was on there, but
wrong
I don't.
Sport.
I don't know that I like merging the
brand.
Ski thing with hockey, and like it's two different winter sports, man.
Yeah. So, Natalie, when you're thinking about the advice council that you give to electeds all the time and the work that you're doing, what do you think are the key issues that people should be paying attention to when it comes to these kinds of developments, or some might say taxpayer or boondoggles that are on the horizon.
Yeah,
potentially.
I mean,
tell me what you think people should be paying attention
to.
Well,
the main thing I would pay attention to is that in the information age, it's all about talent. And in the talent age, it's often about amenities. You're trying to keep and attract talented human capital, and they can live anywhere they want, and they pick places with high amenity value. And an urban environment, a capital city with, you know, sports, entertainment, culture is huge amenity. And so you invest in that, not subsidize. You invest in it because it pays you off over the long term. So all this literature you read about boondoggles and sports stadiums. This isn't about an arena. I want people to understand this is about land use and long-term investment in the core.
Well, I hope we spend more time talking about this because just a couple weeks ago, I spent the weekend at the Kilby Block Party, seeing our, you know, our state fairgrounds activated in that kind of way. There is something for everybody, but I want to make sure that when we're doing that, that we're also considering those who simply do not have access.
We got 30 seconds left in the program. Should we each give our favorite name or what do we do?
Okay, let's do it. So I did vote. One of the ones that I voted for, I believe, I'm going to feel so silly if it wasn't this, is The Fury. I feel like that's a cool name. It could be really fun. I like The Fury.
It's a little angry, but, you know, Yeti, the Yeti's version that I've seen, you know, on the internet does not look like a real soft guy. He's angry. He's fighting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I'm in the Yeti camp.
Nice.
I saw a nice piece on The Express. And it, which wasn't one of the names, but I thought it had some because of the Pony Express. And
yeah, that's fun.
Transportation.
And,
but
yeah, connection to the Transcontinental Railroad.
Cool.
Yeah. Hey, well, great conversation. Natalie Gochner with Ryan Wilcox, Shereen Gurbani. Programs produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.